Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
When Michael Franzese was initiated into the New York Mafia, he went through a ceremony that involved shedding blood and swearing to never betray the omerta, the code of silence. As Mafia bosses placed a picture of a saint in his hands and set it alight, they told him that his soul would burn in hell if he ever betrayed his mob family. So by all accounts, it's a miracle that Franzese is alive today, because after years in organized crime, climbing the Mafia ladder and becoming one of its most powerful moneymakers since Al Capone, he did the unthinkable. He left the mob. And not only that, but he gave his allegiance to another boss, Jesus Christ, and started spreading a gospel of forgiveness and grace. Michael Franzese's gripping story is the subject of two books, and it's even being made into a feature film. The former mobster joins us now. Welcome to Open House, Michael.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Your story is a pretty amazing story, and it all begins really with your father, John Sonny Franzese, who was one of New York's most feared mafia figures. Tell us a little about John and a little bit about his influence in your life, just to set the scene for us.
Well, my dad had a tremendous influence on my life as a kid growing up. I just about idolized him. He was a great dad, a great husband to my mom, just an all-around good guy in my view. And he was a very powerful figure in the Colombo family. He was their underboss in the 1960s, which is the second in command. And on top of that, he was a very high-profile figure, major target of law enforcement, always in front of the media eye. And, just became one of the superstars in that life at an early age and really climbed the ladder and was destined to take over the family at some point. And he got in some serious trouble back in the 60s. He was indicted in both state and federal courts several times. And after winning some of the state cases, he was convicted in federal court for masterminding a nationwide string of bank robberies. Mm-hmm. Was sentenced to 50 years in federal prison. And in 1970, after losing all of his appeals, he went off to Leavenworth Penitentiary to do that time. And I was devastated when he left. I was actually a college student. I was planning to go to medical school. That's what he wanted for me. And I was just devastated. A 50-year sentence, I just thought my dad would eventually die in prison.
And did he? I mean, what happened with your dad? How many years did he actually serve? Is he still serving?
Well, yeah, my dad is actually 92 years old today. He served approximately 33 years in prison on that sentence. He's been in and out several times and then always violated on his parole for associating with other felons. So he's been in and out and had a pretty rough deal of it over the past, 35, 40 years. But he's home now. He's out on parole.
Uh-huh.
And actually fairly healthy for 92, so hopefully he's going to be around for a while.
Is it true that he was responsible for about 35 murders?
Well, that's what the FBI has claimed. And, I can only tell you this. It's a rough life, and my dad was certainly in the mix of it. And unfortunately, violence is a part of that life. And, I think even more so during my dad's time of coming up in that life, it was pretty rough back then.
Yeah. Can you paint a picture of just what mob life is like then? And particularly for you growing up as a child. I mean, is The Sopranos an exaggerated fact or what?
Well, The Sopranos is really, in my view, not a good indication. I always say if there was a mob boss ever visiting a psychiatrist, you can bet both he and the psychiatrist would be in the trunk of a car by the end of the week. I mean, that would never be allowed. But, it was different. I mean, my dad, being as high profile as he was and such a major target, we had law enforcement around us all the time. I mean, they were surveilling him for a number of years, just about 24/7. And, as a kid growing up, I mean, I didn't like the government. I didn't like law enforcement at all. I grew up with that kind of slanted view. So it was different. I mean, certainly different than most people experience.
And what kind of activities was the mob, and indeed is the mob, involved in today? Is it the classic racketeering? What are the facts?
I guess the best way you could describe it, we had a way around us to be able to move into different segments of society, make inroads, and then eventually take control. And then, in America, when we had major control of the unions in this country, which was very, very significant, You know, we were in the highest levels of some major corporations here in America. We certainly had our hand in politics. And that's the reason I believe that we were successful and thrived and prospered, even though, you know, the government put up a pretty intense war against us for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm. And to what degree was the mob involved in politics? Just local, or how far up did it go?
No, I mean, look, you know, I mean, I don't want to give the impression that they control, you know, major things at such a high level, but did we at certain times have control on a high government federal level? The answer is yes. State level also. You know, law enforcement, yes. I mean, there was a police precinct in Brooklyn, New York, where, you know, whenever I wanted to, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was able to go in there and read through the files and get rid of things that I didn't want in there. And, you know, it was just based upon relationships and deals and money that you, you know, you spread around. So, I mean, and we tried to do that. I mean, we wanted to have, you know, our hand in power sources. So it was something that we... you know, we worked at getting done.
Hmm. This is Open House Across the Nation. Michael Franzese is a former mobster and author of Blood Covenant and a number of other books that tell his amazing story. Out of that, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. So, Michael, you grew up amongst this. I mean, as a child, what was your feelings about the mob? I mean, were you looking forward to becoming a member of the mob, you know, fully and personally, or were you kind of reluctant?
No, it was not my goal. I mean, my dad didn't want that for me. He wanted me to go to school, be a doctor. He told me I needed to get an education. I think he knew that, you know, the street life wasn't the most appropriate thing for anybody.
Mm.
Especially in a world where education was important. So, but the influence was around me all the time. You know, I've always saw my dad with his friends around. I knew he certainly was into something different than the guy next door. I mean, he was always a major source of media attention, so, I mean, I read about him in the newspapers. But, you know, my dad would never bring things into the house. He, no matter what was going on the outside, he tried to make our home life pretty normal. And, you know, he never stressed over it, never really talked about anything. It's just more from observation. And then, of course, when your dad starts getting arrested, you know, a few times, you really figure something's going on.
So what, in the end, was the motivation for you to actually become a member of the mob yourself?
Well, when my dad went away, you know, Joe Colombo, who was then the boss of my family, started to get very close with me, kind of took me under his wing. I was close with his sons. They were, you know, my age and a little bit older. And I started to meet a lot of my dad's friends. You know, they were telling me, Michael, you know, what are you doing going to school? If you don't get on the street and help your father, he's gonna die in prison. And, you know, my dad did a lot of bad things in his life. So did I. I ended up pleading guilty to a crime I was guilty of. But that particular crime that he's doing all this time on, it was a bad case. My dad was not a bank robber. He certainly didn't order bank robberies. And I felt the need to get out and to try to help him overturn that conviction or he would die in prison. So I went to visit him in Leavenworth and told him I had made a decision to leave school and to try to help him out. And he was upset about it at first, but he knew that I had made up my mind, and I was pretty headstrong as a kid. And he basically told me, look, if that's the road you want to take and you're going to be on the street, so to speak, then you need to be on the street the right way. His mind, the right way was to become a member of his life. So he told me, you know, his preparation for that, I think he knew I had it in me and I was capable in his view. So he said, just go home, somebody will be in touch with you, and you just do what you're told from that point. And that was it.
Wow.
And that's how it started for me.
And so what happened then? What was the phone call or the visit, and what did you have to do to become a member?
Well, I was 21 years old, and a captain, a capo regime in the family got in touch with me about 2 weeks after I saw my dad. And took me to see the boss, and Joe Colombo had been shot, seriously wounded. He eventually died from those wounds. A new boss had taken over. His name was Tom DiBella. He's gone now also. And he said, Mike, I got a message from your father. He said, he's proposed you for membership in his life. Is this what you want? And I said, yes. He said, well, here's the deal. From now on, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're on call to serve this family. And that means if your mother is sick and she's dying and the family calls you to service, you leave your mother's side and you come and serve the family, because from now on, we're number one in your life before anything and everything. And he said, when and if we feel you deserve the privilege or you prove yourself worthy enough to become a member, we'll let you know. And so I left there. I was in kind of like a pledge period where I had to do anything and everything I was told to do to prove my worthiness to become a member. During that time, I kind of learned the mob ropes, learned a little bit about bookmaking and shylocking, and just sort of got a good taste of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year later, I guess I proved myself worthy, and I was called into a meeting again. It's funny because it will be 34 years ago that I took an oath and became a made member of the Colombo crime family.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Tell me about it. It was a blood oath, wasn't it?
It was. It's a very solemn ceremony. It's meant to be very imposing. They want you to really understand the gravity of what you're doing and the seriousness of it. And it was midnight. We were in a secluded place in Brooklyn. And it was myself and five other guys that night. And we walked into a room individually where the boss was seated at the head of like a horseshoe configuration. The underboss and the consigliere were seated to his left and right. And all the captains, which were about 15 of us at that time, were alongside of them. And we walked in individually. I walked in front of the boss. He grabbed my hand, took a knife, cut my finger. Some blood dropped on the floor. It is a blood oath. And I cupped my hands. He took a picture of a saint, a Catholic altar card, put it in my hands, and lit it aflame. It didn't hurt. It burned quickly. It was just a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, tonight, Michael Francis, you are being born again into a new life, into mm-hmm. La Cosa Nostra. Mm-hmm. And if you violate what you know about this life or betray your brothers, then you're going to die and burn in hell like the saint is burning in your hands. He said, do you accept? I said, yes, I do. And that's how it started for me.
Gosh. That's something else, isn't it? Born again into the mob. That is, the symbology is very interesting in the sense that it's very religious, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't until, I got into my faith later on when I realized the intensity of being born again the first time into a criminal lifestyle. And, when I look back, I said, wow, the first time I was born again, it was into a life of crime where I spent 17 and a half years every day violating the laws of God and man. And I said, boy, that was really intense.
Yeah, boy. Open House is what you're listening to. Michael Franzese, former member of the mob, is with us right now. Michael, you then become this member of the mob. What was your first job after becoming a fully fledged member?
Well, when you come in as a soldier. One of the funny things that happened that night, after we all took the oath, we went in and did what every Italian does after any occasion. We had a banquet. We ate.
Okay.
And I'll never... Yeah, it's funny. We celebrate no matter what. Anything is an excuse to eat. I'll never forget, one of the captains in the family had a brown paper bag as we were sitting down eating, and he walked over to the boss and he said, okay, boss, do I give them all their bag of money now? The irony being that people think you come into the mob and all of a sudden they start throwing money at you, you become wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's really just the opposite. You start paying up from the first time that you're recognized as an earner. And, you kind of set your own course. And there are guys that earn money and benefit the family in that way. And there are guys that are not as capable. And, they do different work. And I fairly quickly emerged as an earner in the family and, got into a lot of different things. I mean, the sky was the limit. We weren't allowed to deal with drugs. We were told no drugs.
Is that right? That's surprising.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was seriousness enough that if we dealt with drugs, we got killed. I mean, there was absolutely no drug dealing in our family.
Wow.
And that was true throughout most of New York's five families at the time. It was kind of a commission decision. And but anything else just about was fair game. And I got into the traditional gambling. I had a major gambling operation. I had a major loan sharking operation. Just about everybody in that life is involved in that.
Mm.
And then I moved into different areas. I mean, I had control of certain union locals. I was in the contracting business. I owned a couple of automobile dealerships, and on and on and on. I was very aggressive and very determined to make a lot of money because I knew money, you made money in that life and you rose in power. They kind of came hand in hand, not unlike the real world.
Mm.
And then I got involved in a very, very lucrative gasoline tax business, where basically, we were wholesalers in the gas business, collecting taxes from you know, the people and not paying the government, and it turned out to be a very lucrative operation. And in 1980, the boss of my family came to me and he said, "Mike, you're doing a great job," because I was bringing in several million dollars a week into the family and to myself. And he said, "I'm going to make you a cap de gime, a captain." And that's the process. The boss appoints you, and that's it. And from 1980 until about 93, when I consider myself kind of removed from that life, I operated in a pretty high position. And quite honestly, they were grooming me and the boss's son. The boss also had a son who was made around the same time that I was. And the two of us were, they were grooming us to take over the family at some point, you know, between my dad and Junior, who was the boss at the time. And that's the road I was on.
Yeah. Michael, what tactics did you use to gain power over a particular business or a car dealership or whatever it was?
Well, you know, listen, I mean, there's always, you know, the threat, I guess you could say, of intimidation and people knowing that, you know, you can back up what you say if you do say something. And so, you know, I mean, when it came to unions, we were able to unionize a lot of places or use our union clout, you know, to earn money in different areas and contracting in the restaurant business and the security business. So, I mean, the threat of that or the intimidation was always there because people knew who we were.
Mm.
And, you know, it was very beneficial at that time. And then, you know, quite honestly, there were just things that, like my automobile dealerships were ran legitimately. And, you know, I just, with the money that I bought, that I made, rather, I got into different legitimate businesses also.
Okay. And all these dollars, you're saying, you know, you're bringing several million dollars into the family every week. And we're talking about back in the 80s. I mean, this is a lot of money. Where was that money going and what was it going on?
When I came in, I mean, I paid mine directly to the boss.
Yeah.
And what he did with it, I have no idea. I mean, he might have spread it around a little bit, but I'm sure he kept the lion's share for himself. That's just the way it goes. And, you know, I had a pretty big crew to support also. So, you know, the important thing in that life is you make the people around you earn, because it's almost a deal where you're buying loyalty. If people are earning money, they're happy. When they're not earning money, they're unhappy. So, you know, you had to know how to make the people around you happy and make them earn money. And I was, you know, I was pretty well known for that. Everybody around me earned and earned well, and we were known as probably the wealthiest crew in business at that point in time.
Yeah, okay. So here you've got this this petrol deal happening where you're shifting all these billions of dollars worth of petrol and illegally skimming off the tax. That is what finally kind of gets you undone, isn't it?
Yes, because, and just to give you an idea of the kind of money involved, I was selling the tax on a gallon of petrol, as you call it, between the state and the federal tax was approximately 35 to 40 cents a gallon, depending upon the locality you were in.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at the height of my operation. I was selling a half a billion gallons of gas a month.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do the math, you know, 35 cents a gallon, you know, times a half a billion, it was a lot of money coming in. You know, that was the bulk of my income. And, of course, I had a fairly big gambling operation. I had a lot of, you know, Shylock money on the street. So the money was really coming in at that time. And my partner in the business, you know, he ran the operation. I kind of put it together, gave him the ideas, and allowed it to grow. Because in that world, you know, every time you have some success, there's people from your own family or from the other families that are trying to get involved in it, especially when it's an illegal deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job was to protect that and to allow it to grow as big as it could possibly grow. And he ran the inside of the operation. What would happen, he got himself really jammed up on a tax case and ended up cooperating with the government. And when he cooperated, he started to, you know, inform on the operation, on me, and some of the other people involved. So that was the major reason that I took a fall, yeah.
So when he then ratted on you, I guess, in many ways, I mean,
yes.
Did you then ever contemplate putting out a hit on him?
You know, I didn't, because I'll tell you what happened. You know, and I always knew that he was, at some point in time, he could be a problem, because he was, I'll be honest with you, he was 450 pounds, and he was 6'5". He's a big guy.
Mm.
And guys like that don't do good prison time. They can't even fit on the cot that they got to sleep on. So I knew he, you know, he would have a problem at some point in time. But, you know, I got so close with him. His kids called me uncle. My kids called him uncle. And I just decided that I was going to see, you know, how it went. When I heard he was cooperating, you know, I was told to maybe do some things to try to circumvent that. He had people and family on the street, but I wouldn't do that. I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to beat him in court, or I'm going to beat him my way, and eventually that's what I did. But he was very fortunate it was me, because I don't know that others would have taken that that position on it.
This is Open House right across the nation. Michael Franzis used to be a member of the mob. In fact, it is said that he made the most amount of money next to Al Capone for the family. And he's with us now to talk about his story of transformation. What a gripping story it is. Theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. So the authorities catch up with you over this particular tax deal there. What happened from that point on? Did you... I know that you spent some time in prison at some stage. Is this the time?
Well, yeah. What happened was I had become a major target of law enforcement myself, actually, prior to this indictment that I got over the gas tax business. I had been indicted five times previously. I went to trial each time, and my case was either dismissed or I was acquitted in court. So I had a pretty good record. You know, then this case came up, and around the same time, you know, some changes occurred in my life, because I met a woman that I fell very much in love with, and decided that rather than fight this case, I was going to try to take a plea. Mm-hmm. Do some prison time, marry this young woman, move out to California, and eventually try to make my break from the life, because I started to see that, you know, things were really going downhill in that life. I mean, the government was really putting a lot of pressure. A lot of guys were turning informants, and I knew that at some point in time, if I did get convicted, they were going to give me 50 or 100 years. I was probably the youngest guy in action at that point in time, and other guys were getting convicted. They were in their 50s and 60s, and they were getting 100-year sentences. So I said, boy, if I ever get convicted on one of these racketeering cases, they're gonna put me away for life. So I decided to try to make a break, and I did take a plea to racketeering. The main part of the case was this gasoline business stuff, and ended up pleading to a 10-year prison sentence. I had a $15 million restitution and fines, and I had to give up a lot of my assets. I had a jet plane and a helicopter and a couple of houses in different places. So I gave all of that up just to take this plea and marry this woman and try to make a break from the life.
Yeah, and it's around about this time that also your dad let you down too, because I guess you were hoping for a bit of protection probably somewhere around about this time of the story, and he did what good mob members did and put the mob first.
Yeah, you know, I did. I'll be honest with you. I was a little disappointed in, you know, really what it was. I mean, you know, in that life, it's a double-edged sword when you enjoy a lot of success, because then people start to worry about you. You know, maybe you're getting too powerful, and you know, so you got to watch yourself with that. And my dad, I don't know what happened at the time, but, you know, there was a lot of word on the street that I was maybe making more money than I was turning in, and my dad, I think he got a little caught up and a little confused in it, and I don't think he ever intentionally meant to give me any trouble, but he certainly didn't help me in an instance, and that was very disappointing back then, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the fact is that the life of a mob member, not only are you causing trouble for other people in the sense that you're using power to stand over people and make money, you've really got to watch your back the more and more you get successful, because, like you said, there's people within the family who actually start to, you know, wonder whether they need to cash in on a bit of what you're doing too. I mean, from everywhere, from the police, from the authorities, from the people that you're so-called colleagues with, you really are under threat.
You know, it's a very treacherous life, there's no doubt, and you have to, you know, I tell people all the time, if you're a member of that life, a sworn member, and you die of old age, and you die free, you've really accomplished something, because it is a real tough course to navigate, and especially if you become a major target like I was, you know, you have trouble from within, you're always watching the people around you, because, you know, you always have to keep an eye open and know that you never, you know, the guy that could be your best friend can walk you in a room that you'll never walk out of. I mean, yeah. That's just how it goes. And then you got the government on you all the time. So you're really walking a tightrope quite a bit of time, and you know, you got to be alert to that, so it's kind of rough.
Yeah, so when you get into prison, how safe are you there?
You know, I had no trouble in prison at all. As far as from other inmates, you know, prison, my dad taught me a lot of good things, but when I went into prison, he said to me, Mike, remember three things in prison. Three words will help you out a lot. Please, thank you, and excuse me. He said, if you, you know, you show respect in there, you'll never have a problem. And I never did. The only time I had a problem is when it became public that I was leaving the life, and I never realized it would blow up and become such a major, you know, newsworthy story. But when that happened, the government, you know, got word from their informants that my life was in danger, so they locked me down. But I never had any individual threat from an inmate, but they kept me locked down quite a bit.
Yeah. You've already mentioned this girl that you fell in love with, Camille her name is. Now, what happened there? Did she stay around for the years that you spent in prison?
Well, she did, actually. Her and I are still together. It's 24 years later, and somehow, some way, don't ask me how, she made it through all of this. But, you know, I always say she's the real story because, you know, I knew what my life was all about, and I chose that course. But, you know, she was 20 years old when I met her. She was a young girl from Anaheim, California. She had no contact with anybody from my life, and she didn't really know about it. You know, you don't really have this influence out on the West Coast like you do in the East. So she didn't know anything about it. You know, she fortunately fell in love with me, and it was too late at that point. And and we went through this whole cycle together, 8 years in prison. And, you know, when I walked away from the life, we had a lot of threats, and we had to move around a lot. And so it was a very, very, very trying and tough time for about 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, now she was a Christian, and so she started to tell you about her boss.
Yeah, she, you know, I mean, I grew up a Catholic, but quite honestly, you know, wasn't a religious or a faithful person at that point in time. I believed in God, but that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, she started to talk to me. She was a Christian about her faith. Her mom was also a very devout Christian, and you know, it was more so because I respected her beliefs and I respected what she believed in. She's the one that made me realize, you know, I fell in love with her. And I said, man, if I'm going to be with this girl, my life is a direct contradiction to what she believes. And for some strange reason, she became more important to me than the oath that I took, than this relationship with my dad. I fell in love with her, and love is a pretty powerful deal. And, you know, so she talked to me about Christ, and I'd listened just out of respect. But, you know, I wasn't really buying too much into it at that time.
And what turned that around? At what stage did you then buy in?
Well, I tell you, you know, I mean, what was attractive to me, she said, you know, the Lord knows your heart, and he'll forgive you your sins. And I said, well, you know, I'm a sinner. Why wouldn't I want to be forgiven? That was attractive to me.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the second part about surrendering my life to Jesus, well, I couldn't buy into that because I grew up under the old, you know, process, thought process that God helps those who help themselves.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a sign of weakness to surrender or to rely or to depend on anybody, and I don't think God would want me to do that. So I couldn't grasp that part of it. So I had one foot in, one foot out, but, you know, she was such a powerful influence, so I did listened to what she had to say. We started to attend church a little bit. But I go into prison, spent 5 years in there, come out under some real rough conditions because by that time it was public. I had walked away and my life was in pretty serious danger at times. And the government really tried to get me to become an informant. They wanted me to cooperate. They offered me the witness protection program, and I didn't want to do that. I wasn't interested in testifying against anybody. I wasn't mad at anybody back there. I just wanted out of the life. Well, they didn't take that too kindly, and after 13 months on parole, which was probably the worst time of my life, I got violated and sent back to prison. And the government, the authorities here said to me, you're going away for the rest of your life. We're done with you. That's it. And so it was that night in a jail cell, quite honestly, when I really thought that my life was over. I felt like I totally lost control of my situation. There was nothing I can do to help myself. I'd probably lose my wife. She had already waited for me a long time. We had some real rough conditions, and how was she going to do it now? And I had nobody to turn to, and that was the night I kind of turned to God. All the influence and all the things my wife had told me and her mother-in-law, I said, it all came into play that night, and it was a prison guard that handed me a Bible that night, and I started to read it, and from that point on, my life started to make a dramatic change.
Wow. So how long had it been that your wife had been sharing Jesus Christ with you until that night?
Well, that happened, I can tell you exactly. I met my wife in 84, and we got married in 85. I went to prison in 85, and this was November 13th, 1991.
Okay.
That was the night that I really turned to the Lord and said, God, if you're really up there, I don't know what to do, and, you know, I'm going to give you my life because I can't figure this out. So it was really out of desperation, but I found out something, you know, and in my experience since then is God will take you any way he can get you.
Yeah, and sometimes he's got to use some pretty drastic means to actually finally get our attention. But the key aspect of your part, the Christian part of your story, is actually this word surrender. It's not just a matter of believing. You believed in God when you were a mob member. You believed in God as a kid. It was a surrendering your life to Jesus Christ so that he actually had complete control and ownership over it. That's the key.
Yeah, that was absolutely the key. You know, it's not enough to just believe in him, because I believe now, and certainly the way my life has played out since then, is that God does have a plan and a purpose for each one of us. And unless we have a relationship with Jesus, we don't know what that plan is, because I believe the Lord speaks to my heart all the time now.
Mm.
And I never listened until that night when he really got my attention. I believe, like you just said, he said, you know what, Francis, there's no other way I'm going to get your attention. You think you have it under control and you're, you know, in control of your life. Well, you're not. And now I'm going to bring you to a point where you have nowhere else to turn but me. And he knew with me that was the only way I was going to go down and listen, because, you know, I was too stubborn. And the way my life has been navigated since then, I realized that God got my attention that night. He had a different plan and a purpose for me. And through the 29 months I spent in solitary, I was in the hole for 29 months, and that's 24/7 lockdown. And it was during that time that my relationship with Christ became so strong, because I read my Bible, you know, countless day in and day out, and I read every Christian book that you can imagine. I would listen to some great evangelists on my Sony Walkman during that time. It was just me and God in that cell. That was it. And he prepared me for what I believe my purpose is now in life, and it certainly has played out that way. It's no coincidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tell people all the time, nobody could have forced me or coerced me or tricked me or did anything to get me to believe in Jesus the way I do now.
Yeah.
It was totally on him, and it was totally my search for the truth and the evidence to prove that, you know, he really is the Son of God and the Bible is the Word of God that brought me to where I am today. And boy, I thank him for it.
Yeah, I bet you do. Open House is what you're listening to. Michael Franzese, former mob member, is with us. You just heard his amazing story of having his life turned around by this encounter with Jesus. Now, Michael, you talked about the fact that when it became public that you had actually walked away from the mob, and 30-odd minutes ago, you talked about this very solemn blood oath you took, that if you did walk away from the mob, you would die. Tell me about the things that you and Camille had to put into place then when you came out of jail and your life was under threat. How many times did you move? What did you have to do?
Well, it was, I couldn't put a house in my name, a car in my name, any utilities, any way that I could be identified through any of those sources, I couldn't do. And since I refused government protection, it was up to me to, you know, to get aliases or get other people to, you know, to own a house for me and to put my utilities in their name, so on and so forth. You know, we had to move more than once because the FBI is obligated to tell us if they believe there's a threat on my life that's serious, and they would get word from their informants, a number of times that I had to move or that they were locating me, and I had to get out of town. So we had to move several times and move around several times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a stressful. The 13 months I spent on parole was the worst time of my life because of that. So, you know, and I had to change my whole life. I mean, I had to make sure, I couldn't go to certain places that I knew were no good for me. I mean, I wouldn't create a pattern in my life, like walk my dog every morning at 7 o'clock. So if somebody was watching me, they say, hey, every morning at 7, here's where he is.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to a certain restaurant, you know, once or twice a week and sit there so that somebody can identify a pattern in my life. And so I had to change all the things that I knew could put me in serious jeopardy. And, you know, quite honestly, I can tell you this. I just about outlasted everybody that had an infamy, because everybody I know in that life is either dead or in prison forever. Huh. I told you the night that I got made that I took the oath, there was six of us.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the only one alive today, and not one of them died. Not one of them died of natural causes.
Huh.
So, I mean...
And Michael, are debts passed down to other family members in the sense that, okay, you're no longer... haunted by those guys that you got initiated with or anything like that, you've outlasted them. But is there still kind of a contract out on your life? I mean, are you still under threat today at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, I could not go back to Brooklyn and say, hey, guys, I'm moving back into the neighborhood. I don't think I'd last a day.
Yeah.
Because that would be kind of thumbing my nose in the face of everybody. But, you know, a big major thing that helped my survival was that when they realized I wasn't going to testify against anybody, because the government had made them believe I was, they had put my name on the witness list of some trials that were going on in New York. So I was even telling my dad, Dad, you're not going to understand what I'm doing, but I'm not going to hurt anybody. And then they see my name come up on a witness list and trials that are going on with major mob guys, friends of mine. And so they didn't believe me.
Mm.
And it wasn't until all these trials came up and I never appeared, and then I get violated, and people are saying, wait a second. You know, he gets violated on his parole. If he was cooperating, they wouldn't violate him. And all these trials, which took a number of years, you know, these trials don't happen overnight. So over a period of 3, 4, 5 years, each trial that I was listed to come in as a witness on, I never showed up. Well, then they started to realize, well, he's no threat to us, but, you know, he did turn his back, and that's enough to get you killed. And my boss, who is... Boy, if he had it his way, I'd be gone a long time ago. But he's doing life now in prison, and he's 80 years old, and he's lost a lot of power in the family. So, like I said, I outlasted, you know, just about everybody that was a serious threat for me. So I've been very blessed in that regard.
Yeah, sure. Michael, you mentioned that you didn't want to become an informant for the police. What do you say to folks who might say, well, hang on a sec, isn't there a justice issue here that, you know, you should actually, for the sake of the community, for the sake of the victims of other mob members, you should actually share information?
You know, let me be clear on that. One of the amazing turnarounds for me is that, you know, at one point in time, like I said earlier, I hated law enforcement. And now I have many friends in law enforcement because I finally realized they're the good guys, we were the bad guys. And I do conferences for the FBI. I do conference. One of my best friends is the police chief of Beverly Hills, and he and I, he happens to be a Christian, and we're very close.
Mm-hmm.
And I do conferences, and I assist them working with at-risk youth. I work with the sheriff's department. I do all of those things. But I just feel, you know, I cannot bring myself to testify against guys that I knew I was just as bad at them at one point in time. And for me to go destroy their life and work for the government, it's not in me to do that. And, you know, I help them in other ways, but I don't think, and I know this may be hard to understand, but I don't think I'm justified in betraying people that at this point in time have done me no harm. And you know, my own experience is, I'm going to be honest with you, I've sat through 5 criminal trials myself. I've seen a number of informants get up on the stand who say that, you know, they've turned their life around, they're doing the right thing, when basically they're trying to get out of prison, and I've never seen an informant get on the witness stand that didn't lie. And it really turned me off. Because if you're doing this for a self-serving reason, then you shouldn't be responsible for destroying another person's life. It doesn't make you any better. And, you know, look, I mean, I'm sure everybody's familiar with John Gotti. He was a friend of mine, and you know, John is who he was. And Sammy the Bull, I knew him pretty well. And, you know, in our justice system, for a man to admit to 19 murders and then get a pass on that because he testified against the guy who might be as bad, may not be as bad as him. I mean, 19 murders, no matter how you cut it, that's a lot of crime. And, you know, to make a deal with somebody like that and let him get off scot-free because he testified against somebody, until today, my mentality is that that's just not just. And
absolutely,
I don't want to be a part of that.
You mentioned John Gotti there. When he was arrested, some heralded as the end of the mafia. Do you think that's true? I mean, how strong is the mafia today in the United States?
Yeah, you know, John's position in that life was highly exaggerated. I mean, John was the boss of his family. Remember, there are five families in New York, and there's never, no one guy, no arrest of one guy is ever going to destroy the whole family. Nobody has that much authority or that much clout. And, you know, John, when John got arrested, and obviously when he died, it caused some unrest within his own family, because now there's always a void that has to be filled in leadership. Mm. You know, but a lot of people felt on the street that John wasn't good for the life because he was too public and he brought too much heat. And that was a thought that was shared by a lot of people. You know, today, to answer your question, I don't think we'll see it disappear in my lifetime. When I left the life, we had 115 made members, guys that took the oath. Mm-hmm. And then obviously you got, you know, I had 300 associates around me. Every guy's got a number of people around him.
Boy.
But today, there are still 115 members. You know, they replace guys. Guy goes to jail, a guy dies, they bring another guy in. So the numbers are still the same. The government here in this country has certainly put a lot of pressure and taken a lot of control away from that life. But don't let anybody kid you. These guys are pretty resourceful, and they find a way to earn money and to stay in existence, and that's still happening now.
Yeah. Have you had any opportunity to share your newfound faith? Or it's a few years old now, but you know, have you had any opportunity to share your faith with anybody else within the family?
It's recently, in the last year, and I pray about that because I don't know if ultimately that's what God has in store for me, but I've prayed about that and said, Lord, if that's your direction, then let it happen. And, you know, I was very reluctant. I travel this country, and I'm in a different church every weekend, and I do a lot of secular things, too. But I was always reluctant to speak publicly in the New York area because I just said it wouldn't be good for me. Mm. I obviously have security issues. But 13 months ago, I first spoke at a church in New Jersey, which is close to my home base. And since then, I've spoken four times and have been received extremely well. And in the past year, I've had three people from the street contact me. You know, Mike, is this for real with you? You know, what's really going on? And if it is, you know, we want to be with you. We want to get close to you. And one guy in particular that I'm ministering to now. So maybe that is a plan that God may have, but you know, I don't push it. I kind of let it play itself out and see if this is really the direction I should be going in.
Yeah, sure. Michael, what an amazing, amazing story you've got. I mean, I do a lot of conversations like this, and this one certainly has opened my eyes to a number of things. What are the plans and dreams for the future for you now?
Well, you know, I know people say this, but quite honestly, I never planned to do what I'm doing now. If you would have said to me when I was walking out of prison, hey, Mike, you're going to be, you know, speaking in churches, working with all the pro sports leagues, working with underprivileged kids, with gangbangers on the street, you're going to be writing books and they're going to be making a movie about you and a television series next year, I would have said, you're crazy. I never had any plan or intention to do this. It just unfolded through a series of events, and I believe, like I said, all to fulfill God's purpose in my life. So I really take one day at a time. I mean, I have a direction now. I am a career speaker. I mean, I'm booked speaking engagements through next year. And we just got to see where it ultimately leads. I mean, I don't really know, and I can't say I have an end game on this. I don't know. I just, I'm enjoying the blessings that I've been given, and I've been given a second opportunity in my life and trying to make the most of it and see where God leads.
Yeah, and that's the key thing, isn't it? Now you're following Him, you're following Jesus, and that's the main thing.
It is.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. That has been a most fascinating story, and I'm sure that it's been a great inspiration to so many. Thanks for your time.
Well, I appreciate it, and hopefully I get to see you in the coming months.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get out to Australia. My wife and I have always had a desire to do that. So,
well, I think there'll be quite a few people now that'll be very keen to hear the story in person. So, indeed, we hope we welcome you to our shores one day. Good on you.
Well, that'd be great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, that's Michael Franzese, former member of The Mob. What an amazing story, hey? Still catching my breath. It's told in two books, Blood Covenant and The Good, the Bad, and the Forgiven. If you do a Google search on Michael Franzese, you'll certainly find him. And indeed, we'll look forward to welcoming him into the studio in person next time.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.